This week, the gold market rallied for the fourth week running, while U.S. equities lost a bit of momentum. Welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek. Thanks for rejoining us for another big weekend show with two top guest interviews. Jeffrey Nichols of Roslyn Capital returns with comments on the recent FOMC rate decision and the potential impact on the precious metal sector. The gold bull market never ended. He's holding on to his piggy bank for much higher prices. Then Harry S. Dent Jr. hails from his private island near Puerto Rico. He says, ignore the FOMC rate hikes, buy gold. Slower job growth could cap U.S. equities prices this year. He sees an imminent bubble in stocks, housing, well, frankly, everything except gold and commodities. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. We'd like for you to call into our Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, our mailbox number, 514049. And please help keep Gold Seek Radio on the air by signing up for the Alpha Stocks newsletter. You can find that at our webpage or just send an email message to me at gsr@hughes.net. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Mostly sunny skies appeared over the precious metals market for the fourth week in a row, as investors sought refuge against increasing tensions in the Middle East. The yellow metal picked up $6, finishing around $12.57 an ounce. Silver dropped just 11 cents, ending at $18.15 an ounce, still up well over 12-13% for the year. The precious metals XAU shares added 2.8, ending at 86, while black gold picked up an impressive $1.64 at $52.24 a barrel. The top story driving the markets, gold futures touched a five-month high set earlier in the session amid U.S. airstrikes on Syria. Nearly 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles were launched from nearby destroyers against a Syrian airbase on Friday, according to the regional news source. Attacks caused heavy damage and multiple casualties. Investors again sought shelter from potential blowback. The new administration noted that military operations were a response to, quote, barbaric, end quote, chemical weapons attacks on Syria that left many civilians dead. Elsewhere, according to a Labor Department report, a weaker-than-expected March jobs number boosted demand for gold. The U.S. economy created just 98,000 new jobs, well below the 185,000 expected. However, the unemployment rate plunged 0.2% from 4.7% down to 4.5%, a number we haven't seen in a decade. In related news, on Wednesday afternoon, the latest Fed meeting minutes indicated tighter Fed policies, but the current Fed balance sheet at the FRED website shows one of the biggest upticks in 2 years, suggesting investors must continue to watch what policymakers do and ignore what they say, as a must-missed mentor used to note, keep your eyes on the ball, not the player. Meanwhile, traders kept a close eye on the meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and the Chinese Premier Xi Jinping on Thursday and Friday. The topic du jour? Trade policy. The two sides agreed on a 100-day plan to address their differences on economic issues, which the administration noted was an accomplishment in and of itself. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, as suggested in the latest report, the metals mostly consolidated this week, carving out potential support for the next leg higher. Silver, of course, still with a golden cross in the weekly chart, suggesting a retest of that $21 zenith we saw last year. And the commodities are also showing signs of life, with West Texas Intermediate crude up sharply. The one negative, clearly dollar strength, but the precious metals could continue to rally in the coming months despite strength in the greenback. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly sunny skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange as investors were pleased with solid employment numbers but concerned over the Tomahawk strikes on Syria. By Friday's close, the Dow Jones Industrials gave back just 7 points, finishing near the break-even point at 20,656. The S&P 500 fell 7 points at 23,55 for the week, while the NASDAQ Composite fell 34 points, finishing at 58,77. Lastly, the Bitcoin ETF, GBTC, leaped 7 points, up to 123. Shares of defense contractors rose, with L3 Technologies, ticker LLL, up about 2%, and General Dynamics up about 1%, as well as Tomahawk cruise missile maker Raytheon, ticker RTN, advancing about 1.5%. Bottom line on U.S. equities. The greed and fear index fell to the fearful zone, indicating some signs of a bottom. However, given the potential for further strikes in Syria and related tensions, a consolidation is the most likely outcome for the coming weeks. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio.
Today's featured guest, Jeffrey Nichols from Roslyn Capital. Joining me in this discussion, Jeffrey Nichols from Roslyn Capital.
Well, Chris, it's good to be here with you today.
You just penned an interesting article about a week or so ago. I think it's an excellent synopsis and analysis of how these markets, they had already discounted the Fed's, the FOMC's decision to increase the benchmark overnight lending rate a quarter point. It's intriguing because despite the hawkish talk and the threat of another rate hike or two, when we look at the Fed funds futures, it just didn't rattle the nerve or the resolve of precious metals investors. Please tell us more.
Well, you know, I think all the attention has been paid to the Fed funds rate. It's a nominal interest rate in the sense that it doesn't account for inflation. And the point we've tried to make all along in this recent article and for some time before is that it's really the inflation-adjusted real rate of interest that counts. And the real rate of interest is simply the nominal rate adjusted for inflation. And in the United States and in really around the world, we do have some inflation that is not insignificant. You know, the Fed has a target for the personal consumption expenditure inflation rate, which is very similar to the consumer price index inflation rate that everybody looks at. And if you adjust, if you take that real interest rate, you can see that you're losing money, putting money into an instrument denominated even in the Fed funds rate. Simply because your value of your money is eroding. And that's what people are keying in on and are sensitive to. What is the value of the money that they hold? And the value of the money is decreasing as inflation increases. It's very simple. Inflation is a problem for the economy, even though nobody's paying much attention to it. The consumer price inflation rate has been running under 2% for the last few years, and it's likely to stay at levels around that or even higher. But I want to point out that when you go to the grocery store or you make another purchase, the inflation rate that you're seeing and that you're subject to is really higher than any of these official indexes, consumer price index, producer price index, PEC, inflation rate. Those are indicators, but they're not entirely accurate. They don't take into account the fact that people are moving from higher priced products to lower priced products. When you go to the grocery store and you want to buy a few pounds of meat or chicken or fish, whatever, the package that you're buying is smaller than it was a couple of years ago. Yet the price may be the same or a little higher. To me, that's inflation. You're getting less value for your money. And that's what the financial markets are also paying attention to. How much value is there in your money? And when the value of your money is declining, it's a scenario in which gold prices are likely to rise because gold is a protection of your purchasing power. People who hold gold hold it in part because they don't want to see the value of their money erode, so they put it into precious metals, gold in particular. And that's what you have to be paying attention to. So for the last few months, there's been a lot of talk in world financial markets about the coming Fed funds rate increase. When was it going to take place? Was it going to be January, February? Well, it turned out that it was in March. It was very well discussed, very well reflected already in prices. But in a sense, it was a disappointment because it didn't even take into account the inflation rate. And that's a big problem, one that is likely to continue in the months and years ahead as inflation continues to sort of churn along at a level in which people aren't really paying much attention to the published rate, but feel in their pocketbook and in their wallet what's happening in erosion of the purchasing power of their money.
Inflation remains a huge concern for Americans. One of the more universal, or you might say ubiquitous, indicators, the Big Mac indicator, and I know it makes people chuckle. A very close friend just yesterday was telling me they couldn't believe how the price of a Big Mac had increased. Now, I don't imbibe. I'm a vegetarian. And it's interesting because this is a, as folks know, the McDonald's franchise is worldwide and can be found in virtually every city, like a Starbucks cafe. It tends to be a rather reliable indicator, and it, I think, underscores your thesis that the real rate of inflation, there's a big disconnect between that and what our officials tally. But I'd like to move on to another topic, and that is the idea, yes, inflation is an issue, but what might be an equally pressing issue is the problem of employment and income. With rates being so low for so long, seniors and folks who rely on interest income, it's been a big struggle for them to keep up.
Many people have retirement incomes with fixed, and they don't go up over time. But as inflation goes up over time and the price of goods and services that retirees have to buy, as those prices go up, they find they can afford less and less. You know, they're getting fewer fries, if you will, when they go into Big Mac territory.
I think Americans, not just Americans, and this seems to be a worldwide phenomenon, but I guess we're focusing on the domestic economy. The level of underemployment, which is just an economist's moniker for flipping burgers instead of taking the job that you were prepared for in an institution. So we're seeing a vast underemployment. We're seeing a huge influx in temporary jobs, which really don't translate into stability. You know, the backbone of the middle class has for so long been the idea of job stability, an integral leg, if you will, of that success story.
The official inflation rate, which is about 4.5% these days, doesn't take into account the underemployment of millions of Americans who were laid off their work as engineers or business administrators or salespeople, and instead are now working at, let's say, McDonald's, where they're making a fraction of their income. These people are underemployed, and in the statistic of 4.5% unemployment, it doesn't count these people. They're like non-persons, if you will. And in addition to being underemployed, you have those who would like to go back to work, but there aren't jobs available for them at the salaries that they require to maintain that standard of living. So the statistics on unemployment and employment are inaccurate because they're not measuring the nuances of the employment, unemployment marketplace in the same way that we were talking a minute ago about the inflation statistics not accurately reflecting what's happening in the marketplace. So we're flying with blinders, if you will, and the aircraft is eventually going to crash because economic policies aren't really dealing with the underlying truth of the markets. They're pretending that everything is just hunky-dory, but it's not. And I think one of the reasons gold has done well in the last week, following the Fed meeting and the announcement of an interest rate increase, is that more and more people are coming to realize that the story isn't as rosy as policymakers would make it out to be.
There's a dualistic quality here. With widespread underemployment, non-competitive salaries and earnings, the overwhelming number of employed persons are hit by two forces at once. First, this rising tide of inflation that you've outlined so eloquently, and this struggle to find a meaningful income.
Well, you know, it's a fairly liberal view that we've really got two Americas, one that's doing well financially and one that's barely getting along. And the number of people who fall into that barely getting along group by leaps and bounds, and the number of people who were in the category of we're still doing well, we're getting our bonuses, our salaries are great, our kids are going to private school, blah, blah, blah. That group is shrinking in size. And so if it isn't already, it's placing great strains on American society that we're going to have to recognize eventually and find some way out of this mess.
I'm so glad you brought this up, and unfortunately this show, the topicality doesn't really include homelessness and some of the social issues that go along with it, but I actually find it fascinating. I occasionally watch the YouTube videos, hundreds of them, on this epidemic of tent cities popping up around the United States, of homelessness.
I don't think there's much disagreement that America is heading in the wrong direction when it comes to employment, unemployment, cost of living, and so forth. Disagreement comes over what is the best way to make things work better for more people. You know, so the conservative would say that we have to reduce the role of government, free up the private sector, go hire more people, go have the prices under control, and so forth. The liberal would say we've got the government to come in and fix things. So it isn't that the problem isn't appreciated by most people, whatever their political leanings, it's what the solutions might be. We don't really know what the solutions are, but, you know, it's probably some middle ground. But fortunately or unfortunately, you and I are in businesses that, in a sense, reflect the state of the economy. And as long as we've got inflation problems, and as long as we've got employment, unemployment problems, you know, gold is something that is likely to do well as an investment and as a protection against the problems in the economy.
Because at the Roslyn Capital website that I encourage everyone to bookmark, especially the monthly updates by Jeffrey Nichols here, you have the national debt clock in bold red type as it approaches, I want to say 20, I can't believe I'm saying, $20 trillion. My guess is that you're one of our pundits here on the show who subscribe to the concept that as long as debt keeps soaring, the precious metals remain an attractive asset class.
Oh, yes. With the debt soaring, it becomes increasingly difficult for the federal government to do the things that ought to be done when all of your money is going to pay the interest on the national debt. The interest on national debt is the largest single expenditure item in the federal budget deficit.
I did want to ask you, though, about the precious metals mining sector. This is the phoenix that's truly risen from the ashes in the past, let's say, 18 months, 12 to 18 months. On a percentage basis, it's startling, the recovery that we've seen, if you want to call it a recovery. What are the odds that, in your estimation, that we are entering a new bull market with long-term legs, for lack of a better term, or is this merely a reaction from the startling bear market we had over the last 5 or 6 years?
First, it's my belief that we've been in a long-term bull market for gold and gold-related assets such as mining shares for many years now, and that we've sort of maybe been on pause for the last few years, but the upswing continues and will continue to accelerate, if you will, and we'll see bigger and bigger gains in the years ahead in the prices of gold and precious metals assets. But also it's important, since you brought up mining shares, as well as mining shares may have performed, we have to remember that they're not the same thing as gold and physical gold in the form of bullion or bullion coins. They have associated risks that aren't shared by holding the metal itself. If you invest in a mining company, more than anything else, you're investing in the management of that company, in its business acumen. Gold can go through the roof, and you can have a mining share that isn't doing well and find yourself where you thought you were going to have big gains because of a bull market in gold, find yourself being left out. So we advocate that the place for investors to start is with a physical gold investment, preferably bullion coins like the American Eagle or the Canadian Maple Leaf or the Austrian Philharmonic. These are real gold. Nothing but gold. And there's no management that you have to worry about. You don't have to worry about the political issues wherever the mine might be located. You know, many of these mines that you're talking about are located in countries that unstable or unfriendly governments. You want to put yourself at the mercy of a dictator in Latin America or Asia or Africa, where your mine may be located, and that gold from that mine could be selling at higher and higher prices. But the management may be squandering the receipts, and you're going to be subject to that. So I could go on and on about the risks to alternative assets like mine shares and my preference for physical gold, but I think your viewers and readers have a sense of what I'm talking about.
We're strong advocates here as well of a solid core bullion position of gold and silver for every listener. In fact, I believe that is the traditional foundation of an investment portfolio and really should be of a savings account if you think of what sound, true money actually is.
You know, you can be sure that people across China, a billion people or more in China, and another 800 million or billion people in India were in both of these countries. The economies are much, much bigger than the U.S. and industrial world economies. And we think that the gold price is really being determined by little fluctuations in interest rates in the United States or other, you know, Western economic issues. But in reality, the interest that Chinese people and Indians and others from around the world, from societies where gold has a certain cultural or historic or even religious aspect to it, we forget that these people are also helping shape the gold market and the future gold price. And they're not going anyplace except to the bank to buy more gold. So while we talk about interest rates and inflation in the United States, Fed policy and other issues, what really is going to matter in the long run is whether people in Asia, India and China in particular, what is their attitude towards gold? How much are they buying from us? And what is the impact of that on the world gold price? I say the impact of that on the world gold price is extremely significant. That my forecast of a continuing bull market in gold and historic high prices in years to come is based in part on the idea that people in these other countries are going to continue buying gold, and they're going to buy more as their societies grow. And as their incomes grow, it's only going to make it more difficult for Westerners to acquire gold, etc.
India now has crossed, as I understand it, the billion-person threshold, challenging China as one of the largest nations in the world, and the prime minister knocked the two most widely held currencies to push their economy into a digital economy virtually overnight. And this is a nation where approximately 80 to 85% of the transactions involve cash, meaning bills and coins in hand, whereas contrast and compare that with the United States, which is roughly 30%. So one more reason why part of their customs, as you say, to transact large amounts of gold, they're relearning in real time, as are the Venezuelans, the importance of shielding themselves against their policymakers.
But elsewhere in Asia have a high respect and preponderance of interest in holding gold. And once they buy gold, they rarely sell it back to the marketplace. So in a sense, it's being taken out of circulation and makes it all the more likely that we're going to see surprisingly big jumps in the gold price in years to come. As Westerners, in a sense, vie for gold with Asians, they're going to bid the price up, and we're going to be very surprised to see new historic highs and prices several years from now, possibly a multiple of the recent price.
So many here on the show have expressed in recent years surprise in the lack of upward movement. In other words, it seems as though we should be at 1,500, 2,000 plus gold 6, 12, 18 months ago, that this thing that most obviously has to come to pass has been delayed. Do you have any thoughts there?
One of those who have been surprised by gold's failure to move higher faster. I've been a bull on gold for a long time and anticipate that I'll remain a bull on gold for a long time yet to come. I think one of the issues has been the strength in other asset markets, particularly world equity markets and bond markets. And as a consequence, institutional investors and speculators, large-scale speculators and hedge funds and that type of participant have been attracted to the large size gains that have been available to them in equity markets. Wall Street has been very strong competition for gold, if you will, and a lot of the managed money has gone into ordinary equities. But I see that that's going to be changing in the next few years. One of the things that I look at from day to day is how is the Dow or the S&P 500 doing versus the gold price. And when we have days like today where gold is up fairly sharply for a single day and the stock market is down, it tells me that we may see money being moved from equities into gold, and it takes only a little bit of demand to create big increases in the gold price. And I think that's what we're starting to see recently in recent weeks, and what we're going to see again more so in the next year or several years to come.
Just another great bullet point. As we've mentioned here for quite some time, if just a fraction of pension funds and financial institutions as well as investors redirected funds from just a couple of the Dow components, we're not talking about the other 15,000 or so stocks. Just a small fraction.
You know, we think because we're gold-oriented analysts and investors that the gold market is on a scale similar to Wall Street equity market or government bond market. But really, gold is valued in terms of the amount of trading that goes on from day to day or the amount of gold outstanding in the vaults of savers and Indian women's jewelry boxes and all that. When you add up all that gold, it doesn't amount to much compared to the volume of stock trades on the New York Stock Exchange, for example.
And maybe the takeaway is many folks, close to 100 million, have had phenomenal gains during this stock market climb. It's tied to the indexes. Most stocks have not fared that well. Maybe it's time to lock in some profits and make sure you have a solid 10 to 20% core bullion component of that portfolio.
That's why index funds have become so popular. They rely less or not at all on the wisdom or lack of wisdom of the investment manager running those funds. And as you mentioned, investment advisor who you might pay a management fee to can't even do as well as the broad market averages, the S&P 500, for example. So if we see some of these people wise up and decide they're going to diversify into gold, only a small portion of their portfolio switching into gold will have important ramifications in terms of the price of gold and the relative price of gold vis-a-vis the equity averages.
The insurance policy that should be the foundation of a successful and methodical investment plan. As you pointed out, and we've regularly pointed out, 90 to 95% of professional money managers fail to perform as well as the S&P 500. I mean, that's not to say there isn't the lone Warren Buffett, Paulson, and George Soros, and Jim Rogers, and so many other greats, but the odds of having that type of performance might be likened to being a successful professional athlete. It's kind of stacked against us.
There's only a small number to start.
and that's a great place to wrap up the show with Jeffrey Nichols of Roslyn Capital. This is a must bookmark website. I mean, the Roslyn Gold Commentary every month, it looks like, and I have it bookmarked. I actually have it at the top of my list here, and it's provided free of charge. So, Jeffrey Nichols, we thank you.
Okay, take care.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Welcome back, Harry S. Dent Jr.
Oh, hi, Chris. Nice to be back.
You know, the recent Fed rhetoric from the FOMC, they may have raised rates a quarter point, but there's a lot of dovish talk from the Fed. Do you expect more rate hikes ahead, and what will that mean for the markets?
Well, you know, I mean, that's always hard to call. I mean, there's going to be at least another couple. My own thought is that they won't raise another maybe two times this year. But by late this year, early next year, I do think the economy's likely to weaken again, and then the dovish talk will escalate very quickly. You've got another wild card, is that Yellen's not expected to stay in with Trump in after March when her term expires. I think it's kind of hard to overly guess what the Fed's going to do. I still think the economy's more important. The economy stays as strong as it's been with job growth and stuff. Yes, they'll keep hiking rates. They'd be crazy not to. Inflation's also been edging up, but it turns around and slows down again. My theory, Chris, is very simple. Economists don't recognize the fundamental trend. Workforce growth is barely growing. In fact, it should shrink a little bit with increased baby boom retirement in the years ahead. All we've been doing with all this stimulus is hiring back people we laid off in the Great Recession. And once we get to full employment, and we're very close at 4.6 to 4.7% recently, there's not going to be people to hire, or you're going to start to have to pay a premium to lure people left voluntarily back in, and neither of those good. So I think job growth, if we may have another 3 to 6 months of this, you know, 200,000 job growth, but I think that could surprisingly come to an end. That's going to be a shock to the stock market, because how are we going to grow without those jobs?
But, you know, we've seen a lot of negative talk on the stock market the whole way up from 2009. What do you think it's going to take to get the market to roll over this time?
Well, how about California proposing to secede from the union? You know, how about, you know, job growth all of a sudden decelerate? Nobody can figure out why. How about the Greek, the next, the certain Greek default due for July, just when this petition in California is due to bleed it? Or for voting on succeeding, what if the Greek default brings up the issue, well, what about Italy, of the bad loans and in the whole Eurozone,
way more than anybody else, and they're in deep trouble, non-performing loans. There's no question in my mind, this market wants to go up, and it uses every reason possible. They thought Trump was going to be a wrecking ball. Next thing you know, now he's looking more like a wrecking ball. But the markets always find a reason to go up unless something serious happens. You know, like Italy threatening to leave the euro, or California threatening to leave the U.S., or growth decelerating, or a rapid rise of inflation. But I think there's a lot of things like that that could happen later this year. And I'm telling my subscribers, July is the most likely month I can see for a peak in stocks, and I don't expect any peak before that.
Give me your thoughts then on the new health care bill. You know, there's been considerable contempt, you might even say, on this topic. Obviously, they kicked it out. They pulled it off the floor on Friday. How important is this to our financial sector? How will, you know, insurance companies and the banking segment be impacted by this bill? And do you expect it to pass?
Well, you know, ultimately, they're going to have to do something, but they tried to push it too hard. And Trump's got this thing about my way or the highway, and I'll take my marbles and go home. And he says the Democrats didn't support it. No, a lot of Republicans didn't support it. That's what you'd expect. You'd expect Democrats not to support it. So, it just shows the market's got this typical bubble reaction. Oh, Trump's going to cut taxes and reform health care and cut deregulation. And he's just going to be able to walk in as an outsider and do it. Smart people have been saying all along, no, this is not going to be so easy, and the Republicans are not as united behind him as people assume, even though they have a majority. So I think the health care thing just shows, hey, I mean, that'll have to go through some ways, because you can't just leave it the way it is, because it is failing. But it's not going to be easy, and if that's not easy, then maybe the tax cuts aren't easy, and the deregulations are not easy. And the longer it takes for any of this stuff to go through, and the more it goes through partially, what it means to the economy is, hey, we were looking for more stimulus. You know, we stopped the QE a good while ago, and the QE working less and less in Japan and Europe, where they are still going full throttle. So, I mean, QE doesn't work forever. You switched over. Oh, well, we're going to do fiscal stimulus. More stimulus on top of stimulus. How can you keep running an economy on artificial additives and steroids? And that's what we've been doing. So I think that's why at some point, stretching the economy, keep stretching the bubble, and then something goes wrong. Next thing you know, the markets are breaking down, and everybody realizes, oh, it was a bubble. Because this is a bubble. This looks like every bubble in history, only worse, more global, more pervasive in markets. It's real estate, it's been commodities, stocks, everything. And bubbles burst. That's all they do in history. While they're building, markets ignore them, pundits ignore them, everybody says it's not a bubble because this and that. This happens every single time in history. People like me who question the bubbles and say, no, I'm sorry, the bubble's going to burst, gets derided. People just don't want to hear it. Well, that's not a good sign. But I think, you know, your first question is the most accurate. What is it? It's going to take something to break the market's reality. And number one reality is just simply, and I'm saying this, I'm going on the record saying this is demographically impossible. I don't care what Trump, he can cut taxes to zero. You cannot create 4% economic growth in an aging society with unprecedented debt levels. It is impossible, and if you don't think so, ask Japan. They've been simulating 3 times our rate as extreme and for 2 decades instead of 7-8 years. And they're still flirting with zero growth, zero productivity, and zero inflation because old people don't get more productive and don't spend more money or earn more money.
Give us an idea about inflation. You know, obviously the Fed officials are concerned about the potential for this economy to start overheating. They want to put the brakes on it, but obviously they're also, on the other hand, a bit concerned that they might do so prematurely. You know, you touched on it just a bit, but they see something the rest of us maybe don't see. Do you see 1970s style galloping inflation, or is that a relic of the past?
Well, it's a cyclical relic of the past. We get our economy, and I show this clearly in all my books, and even the latest one, The Sale of a Lifetime. Our economy goes over about a human lifetime through 4 seasons, a mild inflation spring boom, like 42 to 68, an inflationary extended recession, like 68 to 80, again, with high inflation, in a disinflationary, what I call bubble boom, because low inflation and falling rates always help create bubbles in financial assets. And then when all of that, the debt and financial bubbles get extreme, it blows up, you get a deflationary winter season downturn like 1929 to 42. And of course, that is the worst season. We're in that season. It started in 2008, but that's precisely why central banks are so desperately inflating. The problem is that inflation is only countering the natural deflation of debt deleveraging and financial bubble bursting. In fact, their whole job is just to keep the bubble going, keep talking it up, keep saying it's not a bubble, keep putting money in the system so people will continue to chase financial assets, and just cross your fingers and hope something doesn't go wrong and the bubble blows again like the subprime crisis. And it will. Something will go wrong at a point. And I think now sooner than later, but this last Trump rally to me is the clearest trend I've seen in a while. It's a clear, irrational blow-off rally. He's not going to be able to do the thing on the radio one night. It's just that this is not going to work out well. I think he's telling people, look, would you rather get out of the bubble a little late or a little early? Well, the first crack in most major bubbles, tech bubbles to the 1929 bubbles and all the great bubbles in history, they tend to crash 40% or more in the first 2.5 months. So if you wait for signs that the bubble's finally ended.
Exactly. No, I mean, it's just what physicians regularly inform us, that half of heart attacks, the first sign is instant death. It's sad and unfortunate, but we have to prepare. You brought up the idea of subprime. Well, we have another sector that looks as though it's in a subprime-like debacle, and that's student loans, student debt. This is another $1 trillion market, somewhat similar to credit cards, although credit cards, for the most part, are not secured. These loans are shaky because they tend to be given to folks who really don't have a track record of regular payments. Do you see this as, you know, maybe one of the legs on the shaky economic table?
Yeah, I think if you put the student loans together with the subprime auto, which is much more exaggerated this time than last time. The housing, the subprime and housing and mortgages is not, because they learned their lesson. They got whacked so hard. The student loans plus the auto subprime together, yeah, I mean, you've got $2+ trillion of debt that can blow up, and already it's starting to blow up. Delinquencies are rising on the auto loans and student loans have been rising. And of course, yeah, they're given to young people who don't have high income debt, and like you said, a track record of paying off debt, and they're in an economy that's not as good as it was for the baby boomers at their age, so they're having a hard time buying a home and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, this is not going to end well either. There's no way these student loans are going to be paid off, and no way these subprime auto loans paid off. And another one of many things that will go wrong at some time. And remember, when the subprime crisis happened, people saw it happening. It's just, oh, you know, Bernanke said, oh, no problem, we can handle this. Oh, it's not that big. No, it took down the whole world. Because all it did was prick a bubble. Yes, it was just four states, and it wasn't like it was only a small fraction of the debt. But it made investors, it brought them down to reality. Like I said earlier, something's got to happen to bring investors out of la-la land into reality about the politics, about the geopolitical cycle, things in the world, about the weak demographics, about the ever-growing debt that only is a heavier and heavier burden. And then they start looking at everything. Because when the subprime loans go bad, then they look at all junk bonds, and they look at this, and they look at other loans. And that's what's going to happen. And then the market gets more real. And then these bubbles start to burst because investors don't buy it anymore. And when the bubbles burst, wealth gets destroyed, and then you just get a domino effect downhill. So it just takes something to prick it. The subprime crisis was not the crisis. The crisis back in 2008 and 9 was unprecedented debt levels at all part levels of the economy and all around the world. And it just took something to bring that reality out of the bubble. And I'm just waiting for something to go wrong. And I think by, you know, the second half of this year, I'm just putting out an issue right now. There's, you know, six things that could go wrong. And so that is what I see happening. This bubble's already going to burst. There's no possible other scenario. It's just what's going to prick it and when.
In previous discussions on the show, you have kept a close eye on one of our top trading partners, of course, China, the economic powerhouse, and you're less impressed. You think that this might just be one of the dominoes that brings the economic system to its knees.
Yeah, 100%. It just may be the last that they have created a bubble so extensive in a country. I mean, they have first world levels of debt, and we're way overstretched. For a country that's still an emerging country, you know, with an average income of $6,000 per capita. And they've done it in real estate and in overbuilding, you know, 27% empty condos in the major cities and whole cities built for a million that are still largely empty, railways to nowhere. The largest mall in the world had to be converted into a tourist attraction because there were no retailers in it. They just built stuff for nobody. So they can keep urbanizing rapidly, but they're building stuff for nobody. And now last year I showed that migrant workers are actually net going back to rural areas again because the real estate costs, the pollution, and the traffic is so horrendous, and they're treated like second-class citizens. They're treated like illegal immigrants from Mexico in the United States. They're not even registered citizens in these urban areas. So that bubble is going to blow. Governments have overexpanded. That's why free market capitalism works better than dictatorships and communist governments, because they just do this sort of stuff. They just, you know, grow by building stuff for nobody because it keeps everybody happy in the short term. And that's what politicians do when there's no restraints on them. And that's what China's done. They've made Russia look like teetotalers. And then the whole Russian top-down, centrally planned economy has never worked. And they're still incredibly poor compared to their education level because it doesn't work. Accountability works. And even though in free markets we can get in bubbles like we have now, they will end at some point and the chickens will come home to roost and then people will make real changes and then progress will come forth. In China, they just keep building stuff for nothing and they're going to do that until something goes wrong. Well, what I say has gone wrong is the rural migrant workers, we're going home. We've had enough of this. It doesn't work for us anymore. And if those people don't keep moving to cities, then you don't create more jobs. And it's impossible to keep building stuff for nobody. Because at least now you can rationalize and say, yeah, we got a lot of empty stuff, but at the rate people are migrating, we're going to need it one day. Well, what when the migration is going back the other way, which has already been for 2015 and 16, 2 years straight, migrant workers, more people have gone back to rural areas than to urban areas, so you can't keep building stuff for nobody when the trend is reversing on you. You can do it when the trend's in your favor. It's no longer in their favor. So whenever the world wakes up to that, people are going to realize what I'm saying, and I'm 100% on this, not even 99. China is the greatest bubble in all of modern history, and when it bursts, it will be one of the greatest bubble bursts. And no amount of quantitative easing is going to be able to fight that.
We've heard the term ghost villages, ghost towns, but when you start to read articles about ghost megalopolises in China, that's what Harry S. Dent says is the wake-up call, the tipping point where the system, the global system, is in trouble. Okay, that's something to keep an eye out for. How much of this economic strength that we supposedly see here, you know, in the United States is a direct result of capital fleeing the very shaky EU and other nations around the world? The EU is just disintegrating. If and when that capital flow reverses, what will that mean for the United States, or will it matter at all?
It is a train wreck, and it is going to continue to disintegrate. It was kind of flawed in the beginning. And Europe is a very diverse group of nations on very different systems and very different, much, much greater differentiation in cultures and in income. I mean, southern Italy has half the GDP per capita of northern Italy. Much more rural, much less urban, non-industrial, fishermen, stuff like that, small restaurants. It's two different worlds. Even Mississippi and California are not that different. It's hard to integrate that. And you have this huge imbalance created by the euro itself, which made the currencies of places like Germany lower than they'd be on their own, made them more competitive, but also allowed the southern countries, the weaker countries, to borrow at lower rates, being part of the euro, which allowed them to rack up debt like Italy and Spain and all these countries. And now you got a mess. And so it is going to blow, but I tell you, the thing people also don't see, China is leading this trend. Affluent people are laundering their money out of that country at the speed of light, and they do it by buying expensive real estate and say, oh, it's just for my kid while they're at, you know, a California college or something. They don't trust their government. They know they have a top-down government. I mean, China is one of the few places where some of the richest people come out and say, we're in a bubble. Nobody says that. The largest real estate developer in all the country said, this is a bubble. You know, the richest billionaire in China, the richest person is selling their commercial real estate, which is tons and tons, as fast as they can. The smart people over there are very clear. It's not going to be a good outcome. It is a bubble and will burst. So they're finding every way to get their money out of the country. They're doing it faster than the Europeans are. The Europeans are going to have to wait until something fails or wait until, like in Cyprus, you know, they come in and start swiping half of your bank account if you have over 100,000 euros before they get it and say, yeah, we need to get our money out of here. If I had money over there, I'd have it out of there already.
No, exactly. I love these terms they use, rehypothecation. It's being written into the literature all over, in legislation all over the world. I mean, it started, as you mentioned, in the Cyprus area, moved up to Poland. It's even being written into municipal and state legislation here in the United States. So, of course, we all remember MF Global, how quickly our funds can be stolen, rehypothecated. So give us a quick synopsis of what you see for the gold market and precious metal stocks. I mean, obviously, they've done quite well this year. We've had a tough 5 or 6 years. Can we, you know, muster the strength for a rally here in the next 2 to 3 years?
Yeah, no, I don't think that. We were calling, you know, gold was definitely oversold at 1,050. We said, look, this is going to go back to around 1,400, and it did, and then it started going down again. Now it's bouncing because everything else doesn't look so good. And I think gold may have a little bit left in this bounce, but I think gold, it is an inflation hedge, and ultimately deflation is going to win here. And commodities, gold is also part of the bigger commodity cycle. It peaked in 1980 and peaked in 2011 with a lot of other metals and stuff. I think it's got further to go ultimately, but it's probably one of the first places I would be reinvesting. Commodities have been the bubble that have burst the most. Gold has held up better than most other metals and commodities. And I think, you know, in the next year or two, when we get kind of like bubbles bursting everywhere, I'm expecting the two markets that will come out the strongest will be commodities, especially metals and energy, and it will be the strongest emerging countries, which means India and Southeast Asia more than China, because China's already peaked in workforce growth and has this overbuilding problem that could take a decade, a minimum of a decade, to work off. And so that's where I'm going to be looking first for my, because all things don't bottom together.
And, of course, on the CRB, we had a false breakout after several months of consolidation. Obviously, the bond market looks like it has finally been burst, that bubble. And then you have equities. Once equities roll over, maybe this year, maybe next year, at some point we have to have a really serious correction. I mean, what are the odds that funds will be searching for some type of safe haven?
Well, you know, I think it's an initial burst. I don't think it's the final burst. I think the high-quality bonds, like the U.S. Treasuries and the AAA corporates, will be the safe haven. They were in 2008. Even when gold and silver got hit along, the Treasuries went up and the U.S. dollar went up, of all things. So I think there'll be another flight to quality at some point. I think bond yields are going higher, maybe for the next several months, but at some point, the failure of the stock market, exactly what you said. People are going to say, well, where do I go now that real estate's going down again and stocks are going down and commodities have been crushed and blah, blah, blah. It's going to take people a while to have some faith in commodities. I think they are going to go to the high-quality, longer-term bonds, and that will create another run. You got to remember, in the 1930s, when the last time we had a deflationary, debt-deleveraging economy, the only time in the last century, best two sectors were the 30-year treasuries and the 20-year AAA corporates. They doubled in value, while commodities, real estate took a long time to come back. They did eventually come back, but it took a while. So gold would be one of my first choices, but I would be buying, if we saw the 10-year treasury at 3% or higher later this year, I'd be buying that first and then wait for the next broader collapse and everything, and then maybe start buying gold and place it, and then emerging markets like India.
We have truly are witnessing, I think you'd agree, you know, a housing bubble 2.0. Plenty of ways to argue that point. I like housing starts. U.S. housing starts, I feel, is one of the strongest leading indicators in the sector, and they remain robust. Just what might end that trend?
Well, you know, there's three things that I call more lagging indicators. That's job growth. Inflation almost always peaks well into the next recession, and then rising inflation helps trigger that by pushing interest rates up. Housing developers just keep building until it blows, and then it gets clammed up, and that's what happened in 2008. And the biggest reason I don't, because I think job growth is about seeing its best. And again, as I said at the beginning of the show, job growth could drop not from 200,000 to 150. Job growth could drop almost suddenly from 200,000 to 50,000. And the long-term workforce growth rate for jobs is 0.2%. That is 25,000 jobs a month, and it's not even that strong in the next 6 years. But even long-term, if you don't have those jobs, new jobs, housing's not going to do well either, because housing primarily sells to people 27 to 41. They're in their prime working years and on the earlier side. And if jobs aren't growing, there's no way housing's going to keep growing.
There's a lot of question marks surrounding the job growth. I mean, even one of the Fed heads last week started to question the, I think he said it was the growth rate of employment. I mean, they have many different ways of looking at it and judging it. But tell us a bit more about the services you provide, how folks can find those services.
Just go to harrydent.com. I've got a free newsletter called Economy and Markets, upper right thing. You just put in your email address, you're on, and you can just get to know us better. I think right now they're offering, my latest book, The Sale of a Lifetime, they will send that to you $4.95. So that's the two best ways to find out more about what I'm saying right now.
Harry S. Dent Jr., we always appreciate your thoughts. Like to hear more of those again in 2017.
Thanks, Chris.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. Systemic financial risk has increased on multiple fronts due to significant developments that have coalesced this week, resulting from actions at the Fed, the U.S. military response in Syria, and a Zero Hedge article from last weekend entitled, Moscow and Beijing joined forces to bypass U.S. dollar in global markets and shift to gold trade. First, Janet Yellen indicated the Fed would begin taking steps to reduce the central bank's massive $4.5 trillion balance sheet. In other words, they are going to begin selling into this market. This marks what is likely a top in real estate prices. The suggestion is that the balance sheet reductions will be far off, as in possibly next year. Or will they? Could this possibly happen sooner? The current mindset or talking points are that this will not occur for some time. An economist at Regions Financial Corp said he doesn't expect the Fed to change balance sheet policy until the second half of 2018. And guess what? That would be just in time for the midterm elections. But he said that prepping markets well in advance makes sense to avoid a repeat of what was called 2013's taper tantrum, when interest rates spiked following the Fed's signal that balance sheet purchases would end. The risk is that interest rates shoot up more than the Fed intends once it starts to reduce the balance sheet. There's more at risk as well. The military response to Syria on the 100th anniversary of the U.S. entering World War I is just the latest. Escalating military conflict appears to have a correlation to time periods where the economy is under significant pressures. Another behind-the-scenes pressure that I have only seen referenced so far on Zero Hedge is how Moscow and Beijing are joining forces to bypass the U.S. dollar in global markets with a shift to more gold trade. The Russian Central Bank opened its first overseas office in Beijing on March 14th, marking a step forward in forging a Beijing and Moscow alliance to bypass the U.S. dollar in the global monetary system and to phase in a gold-backed standard of trade. The new office was part of agreements made between the two countries to seek stronger economic ties, since the sanctions against Russia over the Ukraine crisis and the oil price slump hit the Russian economy. According to the article, the Russian and Chinese central banks are drafting a memorandum of understanding to solve technical issues around China's gold imports from Russia, and the details would be released soon. Risk is increasing everywhere. The Fed's market interventions create risk. Military conflict creates risk. Nations who bypass the U.S. dollar as a means of settling trade creates risk. Get out of debt. Get liquid. And get gold. Decide how you and your family are going to live in harmony against a backdrop of what likely will be more, not less, economic changes going forward. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garnero, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.